Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. Wonder and awe of the beautiful is essential to the human experience. Our souls are often shaped and formed by the aesthetic experiences provided by the Creator. When we neglect this aspect of our lives, we fail to realize how God has created us uniquely to not only enjoy beauty, but to also create the beautiful. A distinctly Christian vision of these realities opens our eyes to see how God has enchanted our world to draw us toward Him, the source and substance of beauty, for a deeper experience of the Christian life. Well, in his new book, Drawn by Beauty, Awe and Wonder in the Christian Life, pastor and theologian Matthew Z. Capps points to the reality that our spirits are formed by God through the beautiful experiences that he offers. This book is a call to not only acknowledge the effect that beauty has on the human spirit, but it is an appreciation of the obviously divine presence in the things of this world that are truly awe-inspiring. And here to talk about his new book, Drawn by Beauty, is Matthew Z. Capps, who is a senior pastor of Fairview Baptist Church in Apex, North Carolina, and a friend of mine and a friend of the program. Is it okay if I call you Matt? Matthew Z. Capps?
I was curious if you're going to call me Matthew the whole time.
Well, it's on the book. I figure it's got to be official. I'll call you. What does the Z stand for? That's what I want to know.
It's Zachary. That's the, yeah, everybody asks, it's Zachary.
Yeah. So, you got to have your middle initial if you're a real author.
That's right, Jared C. Wilson.
Well, I mean, I do say that, I suppose. Yeah, I'm going to call you Matt, even though you are Dr. Matthew Z. Capps. Drawn by Beauty. I was happy to endorse the book. Very happy for the book. We've been friends a long time. And so I remember numerous conversations with you over the years about this concept before. I mean, you know, I think you'd planned to publish on it or to write on it. And I know you did. Didn't you do your dissertation or your PhD piece on this sort of subject?
Well, I did my Doctor of Ministry project at Gordon-Conwell on beauty, aesthetics, and spiritual formation. So a lot of what comes into this book comes out of that project and also out of just personal experience growing up. My dad's an artist, and my college degree is in art. I don't know if you knew that or not, but was trained in the arts for a long time. And so this was the genesis of this work was trying to put together all I knew about the arts and aesthetics with the theological training that I had developed at seminary and trying to offer something for the church that would be helpful in this area. So, yeah.
Yeah, we like things that are for the church, especially. Thank you for throwing that in there. No, I do want to come back to that. I've got some questions for you that I want to ask about art in particular, but the whole book is not about art, at least not formal art or the fine arts per se. You're really talking about, I guess, the broader term. This book is not for academics, or it's not an academic book, but in some ways is obviously shaped by your academic work and your academic approach to the concept of aesthetics. So starting off, you're really talking about beauty and our understanding of beauty. And I remember encountering the question, probably, I guess, in college. I don't know if C.S. Lewis prompted this or not, but like whether beauty is objective or subjective. I don't know if you want to answer that question, but I'm going to ask you because I think it's interesting. I don't know. Is beauty objective or subjective?
Yes.
What a cop out. What a beautiful answer.
I think it's helpful to define terms here. So when you're talking about beauty, I'll just take Thomas Aquinas's definition is essentially beauty is that which is pleasing at the very apprehension of it. Right. And then the term of aesthetics is really, it's a universal experience that people have regardless of their culture or preferences. Aesthetics is derived from the idea of the perception of the senses, or it's the general study of sensation and feeling. And so there is a sense in which, yes, beauty is subjective, but we've all heard the saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
I would probably reword that to say beauty is in what's actually beheld. But then you have to define beauty. I think the best way to look at beauty is to say that God is not only the source of all beautiful, but he himself is beautiful. So any beauty we experience in creation order is derivative of God, is a signpost pointing back to him. Like it's a dim reflection of his beauty. And so I would say beauty is objective in the sense that it's rooted in the being, nature, character of God. He himself is beautiful. He himself is beauty. But there is an aesthetic sense in which we experience that beauty, whether it's him or in creation. So back to my answer, is it subjective or objective? Yes, in different ways. If I'm just going to dance around it, that's the way I'll do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm thinking of like, you know, you've probably seen this too, but there are guys out there who comment on certain kinds of architecture and things, and they'll show a cathedral next to some modern piece of I think the formal term is like brutalist architecture. And they'll say, you know, clearly this is transcendent beauty about the cathedral, and this is, you know, despondent despair or whatever. And, you know, sometimes you pick the best example of one thing and the worst example of another, and you put them next to each other. But there are things, and maybe even buildings, modern architecture things, where I look at it and think that seems peaceful or soothing or inviting, where other people would say, you know, no, that's overbearing, or, you know, and so it has a kind of, that's where the subjective thing kicks in, I suppose. But maybe it sort of introduces, you know, kind of my next question is, why do Christians, you talk about this in chapter 2 of your book, in some ways, why do Christians struggle with the concept of beauty? What's our deficiency with beauty?
I think, in at least in our tradition, like Protestants, Baptists, evangelicals, if you will, we haven't really discussed beauty and aesthetics that much. I mean, I remember when I was doing my work at Gordon Conwell, I just out of curiosity pulled all of my systematic theology books off the shelf and went to the back and just looked for, does anybody talk about beauty? And I think maybe two or three out of the 13 or 14 I had some section on beauty, and most of them were related to the character of God, and beauty was a subcategory of something else. I think there's a sense in which, if you want to use some Disney analogies, beauty is the theological beast, or the Cinderella stepsister to truth and goodness. We know it's there. We just don't talk about it that much. And so that's what I'm trying to do with this book, is kind of bring it out. In chapter 2, I walk through what I think are various reasons. One, we've developed a deep aversion for aesthetics because of fear of idolatry. Like, you can go into Christian history and look at the iconoclast movement, where they're destroying images and whitewashing over paintings because of the fear that would prompt people to idolatry. There's asceticism, which, you know, separates the spiritual from the physical, the immaterial from the material. There's this dichotomy we've created where we don't know how to the two interact with each other. There's other reasons too. Utilitarianism is a big one in my mind. And that goes back to your conversation about buildings. You know, a lot of the buildings now are built for functionality, for utilitarian purposes. So there's not much adornment for the sake of making it beautiful. Like, if it doesn't have a function, then why put it on the building, right? Right. And I think in different cultures that expresses itself in different ways. And two, I think in the theological world, Karl Barth's kind of aversion to natural theology or general revelation, if you will, has really maybe poisoned the waters in a lot of theological discussions. So that stuff, whether it's theological or cultural, I think streams down into the church. And we just don't know what to do with beauty, with aesthetics, with art, because there's so many questions around it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even thinking, I mean, I brought up the cathedral example. It just, you know, church architecture, you know, I feel like there's a reclamation, or at least a renewed interest in a sense of transcendence or beauty or adornment, like you said, mm-hmm. where, you know, church buildings used to, even the plain ones, so to speak, you know, had the steeple. I mean, there was a sense of like, this means something. It's pointing us to heaven. There's a interior, even if there's not a lot of adornment paintings or or ornate fixtures. There is, you know, high ceilings perhaps, or stained glass or something like that. And then into 70s, 80s, 90s, church buildings started looking more like malls or office complexes. And that's an aesthetic choice. But what's been the inheritance of that? What's been the ramifications in terms of, especially for evangelicals? Is that reflective of something, or are we downstream of those choices, do you think?
Yeah, I think it relates to some of the things you've already brought up. I think there's a deep aversion to like anything that would even hint towards idolatry. I think as far as utilitarianism, I think most churches today are built with utilitarian purposes. This is a very nuanced conversation, but I just know when you walk into a cathedral, it doesn't matter how loud and boisterous you are outside, you're laughing and talking. When you walk into a cathedral, there is a sense of transcendence in the room, and everybody just kind of, your posture changes, right? Like you quiet down. There's a sense of reverence there. And that's what the cathedrals were built to do. That's what all the adornment was trying to give you, this sense of an otherworldliness in the space you're in, right? I think we have lost some of that with the utilitarian buildings we have. And I think that is starting to come back. You'll see in a lot of the spaces being built now with higher ceilings and maybe windows and more ornate things. There's a sense in which we've kind of lost that otherworldliness, that transcendental sense of what it means to be in a worship space, right? These are things that should prompt you to lift your eyes to the heavens or to indicate to you that you're in a different type of space, a different type of environment than what you're typically in. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, what's the biblical basis for this? Like, if you're trying to point us to, like, biblically, what concepts, maybe even passages, where should we be looking to get direction or, you know, our formative influence in terms of how we think about aesthetics or to think about beauty in particular?
Yeah, and specifically in worship spaces, perhaps?
No. Just in general, for your book and telling us that we need to be, drawn in by beauty. We need to reflect that. I know you've got talk about image of God and how we do, how that works out. But yeah, what's sort of the biblical sort of foundation for this approach?
Yeah. So if I were to give you a systematic theology of beauty in an elevator speech.
Do it.
The long elevator, it's like a skyscraper, but
we're going to level 48 here. So.
Yes, we are. So
we're in Nakatomi.
you start with the doctrine of revelation. That is the foundational, we can't know anything about God or our world apart from revelation. So you have general revelation where God has made himself evident in creation. Romans 1, chapter 1, verse 20, right? He has made his attributes, his power, his divine nature have been clearly seen in the creation of the world. There's a sense that it's nonverbal revelation. It's in the sense there's delight in the universe. There's beautiful things. It's like you're standing before a painting that points you back to the masterful artist that made it, right? But again, it's nonverbal. So we need somebody to tell us who the artist is. And that's where special revelation comes in. Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God. We would not know what the heavens were declaring without special revelation or God giving us his word to direct all of these affections. So that plays a clarifying role in this conversation, the doctrine of scripture. The world is charged with the grandeur of God, as one of the poets said, and we know that because scripture tells us. I love one of the quotes from Jonathan Edwards. He basically says that we are delighted by flowery meadows because they are of the sweet benevolence of Jesus Christ. Like God gave us those things to open our eyes to their smelling salts, if you will, to point us back to him. But you have revelation. You have the doctrine of God himself. He's perfect. He's without deficiencies. There is no desirable attributes or qualities that he lacks. And so one of the things I say in the book is when you take the doctrine of God and we call God beautiful, that's different than us saying that, maybe an actress is beautiful or an actor is handsome, right? You take an actress and say she's beautiful, you're making a comment about her appearance. Now, her personal life may be a mess. She may not be very ethical. There's probably all kinds of problems there. But when you say God is beautiful, you are saying that there is no variation of turning of shadow in him. Like every part of him is beautiful. He himself is beauty. From Psalm 50, from Zion, the perfection of beauty, God appears in radiance. So you have to, doctrine of revelation, God reveals himself. God himself is beautiful. There's no other being for which beauty can, his beauty is above all other beings. And then you get to the doctrine of Christ. You know, Christ is, you could say, beauty in flesh, right? With Christ's coming, God makes himself, as one author put it, sense perceptible, right? This is beauty in flesh. You know, I think about, what is it? Mount Sinai. Like the Israelites are on the mountain. They're afraid because they don't see God's form. You get to the transfiguration of Christ in the Gospels, and the disciples are afraid because they see Jesus's form. They see him actually as he is. So in Christ, we have this embodiment of beauty. And even on earth, before his ascension, before his glorification, if you will, in his teaching, in his actions, it's beautiful. It's everything's true. Everything's good. Everything's beautiful. He is the embodiment of beautiful. Now, once you get to there, you have to turn back to ourselves and talk about the doctrine of sin, right? Because the light has gone before our eyes. Psalm 38, 1 Corinthians 13, we see through a glass dimly. There's a sense in which because of sin, we don't see things as they are. We don't behold things as beautiful, as truly as we should. This is why people, you know, scripture, Paul says in Corinthians that the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers so they can't see the light of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So beauty's in this world, and the way we perceive beauty is often warped, distributed. We take things that are the materials of creation and we use them to create things for our own glory. We twist them to serve unworthy ends. Statues become idols, right? You think about the darkness of the pornographic imagery. People observe other humans made in the image of God as objects of desire rather than subjects made in the image of God. So we twist all of this to evil ends. And this is where the gospel of Jesus is central to this whole conversation. As Jesus said, I have come to this world in order to, for those who cannot see, to see. And again, back to 2 Corinthians, where Paul says the natural mind is blind to the light of the gospel in the face of Jesus Christ. And it's the Spirit of God that opens our eyes to see and gives us these right categories. And somewhat ironically, this happens at the cross, right? You think about the horror of the cross, and that screams against every sensibility, aesthetic sensibility we might think of. It's bloody. It's horrible, but it's fitting. And Christ is offering himself as the against the collective crime of humanity against him. He's bearing all the ugliness of sin and enduring the indignities of the fallen world. And at the same time, it's one of the most beautiful expressions of God's self-giving love. And so that gives us a gospel-centered understanding of beauty, because Christ's suffering becomes beautiful in the sense that it was vicarious on behalf of you and I as believers, and salvific. There's your seminary word, salvific. It's for redemptive purposes. So what's happening there? And then in the resurrection is our eyes are opened, and all of history, the trajectory of history, moves towards the new heavens and new earth where, and I love this quote by Hans Urs von Balthasar, who's a Catholic theologian. He says, there is a day in which we will quiver before the beauty of God. We will go from being moved by beauty to possessed by it. And what he's talking about is, when we see Christ as he is, when we see him face to face, as it says in the New Testament, when we are drawn to him, and the idea of revelation, where around the throne is the appearance of jasper and rainbow and emerald and these beings encircling the throne. This is this beautiful imagery that's almost overwhelming, aesthetically speaking. And that's when we're going to really experience beauty without hindrance. So there's kind of this idea that for now we experience beauty. We are moved by it, but one day we will be enraptured by it. We'll be, as C.S. Lewis said, we'll be drenched in beauty, right, for all of eternity. So now this is just a small taste. What we experience in this life is a small taste of what's to come.
We would like to take a moment to invite you to campus for our Spring Preview Day on April 11th. Preview Day is a great way to explore how you can be trained in your calling for the church and for the kingdom. At Preview Day, you'll get a behind-the-scenes look at what life at Midwestern Seminary and Spurgeon College would look, including mock lectures, meeting seminary leaders, and connecting with current students on campus. Whether you're interested in online or residential studies, we hope you'll consider joining us for Preview Day. Reserve your spot at mbts.edu/preview. And who knows, you might just run into myself and Jared.
Yeah, like it reminds me, Jonathan Edwards talked about wanting to be wrapped up into heaven and swallowed up in him forever. I love that language, being swallowed up by God forever. Let's shift now to think more of the application for our listeners, for believers. We're going to take that biblical basis, the understanding of beauty, the storyline that you just so well charted out for us as well. And let's put it on the ground in a couple of ways. One of the running bits on this podcast is that my co-host Ross and I always argue about Christian movies. So he likes Christian movies. I do not like Christian movies. And so we argue about that. It's become kind of a running thing. Maybe speak to that specifically, or just art in general, if you prefer, if you're a chicken and don't want to talk about Christian movies. How should we be thinking? So Christians who are creating art, why do we struggle? Whether it's, I'm sure I'm going to make somebody mad, a Thomas Kinkade painting, or just the kitschy sort of Cracker Barrel, you know, gewgaws that pass for Christian decorations, and or Christian movies that seem to fall short on so many levels artistically. What's our problem? What's our malfunction from your framework?
Our malfunction.
If you agree, maybe you like Christian movies. I don't think that you do, but maybe you do. I know if they're hit or miss. There's good ones out there, but in general, they're
hit or miss, mostly miss. The technical word for it is a lot of Christian art has a Pollyanna quality to it.
Okay. Yeah. Pollyanna. Okay.
You know, so it doesn't strike us as real or authentic. And so, you know, I watch a lot of those movies and they're just not as well done. They don't have that sense of authenticity that you might have in another movie where, you know, I understand you're trying to avoid some of the deeper and darker themes that we experience in this world, some of the language, some of the imagery that maybe is not appropriate for certain audiences. But all of us know intuitively when something doesn't strike us as like, this is not how it is.
Yeah.
Right. I think of, one of the examples I give in the book is a painting called Christina, and it's by, I can't think of his name right now, an artist, but it's his neighbor laying in a grass field, reaching up towards her home. And
it's not Homer Winslow, is it? Or
no.
Okay.
It'll hit me in a few seconds. Yeah. Probably when we get off this podcast, I'll just tweet it later. But there's a sense in which like there's some Christian related themes in that book of someone who is broken, is alone, but is reaching for home. And you almost want to help her get there. I think what Christians need to do is learn how to see some of the bigger themes in art in general as relating to our shared life together as humans, but also how even in non-Christian art, things scream with a longing for Christian themes, or they point us to the greater realities that we as Christians have answers for. Art is a lot like a parable, right? We question art, and art questions us. It confronts us with realities. Sometimes it changes our perception of the world. It introduces us into new ways of thinking. And so I don't know what the answer is for Christian movie makers, because I'm not a movie maker. But I think if you watch some of the great films that really move people in audience, they're dealing with really in-depth themes and really difficult struggles that I think a lot of Christian movies and Christian arts, they try to avoid. And I think there's a there's a sense in which we as Christians can watch and view secular art with a redemptive kind of lens and trying to figure out, you know, all the questions this movie's asking, all the questions this art piece is provoking. We have answers, right? Maybe one last thing. I think a lot of Christian art tries to resolve the tension in movies or movies, music tries to resolve a tension that sometimes just needs to sit there. Right. So that would be my answer. I agree with you. A lot of the Christian movies I see are not great. And I wish they'd be a lot better.
Yeah, yeah. The painter is Andrew Wyeth.
There it is. Andrew Wyeth.
And yep. I said Homer Winslow, and I meant Winslow Homer. I don't know why. I was pretty close. Yeah, similar painting. What about spiritual formation? You have a chapter as well where you speak to how our understanding of these things just as another sort of application for us. Why does it matter to the Christian beyond, you know, maybe appreciation of art or appreciation of beauty in general in nature and so forth? But like, how is this in some ways important or crucial even to how we are growing by the Spirit into the likeness of Christ?
Yeah, I mean, human beings, as people created in the image of God, we have this unique gift endowed on us by our Creator. We're endowed to create beautiful things, and we're given this specific ability to enjoy beautiful things like the arts. Like, you know, your pet cat. You have a pet cat? No, you don't like cats.
Brother, you know I don't have a pet cat. Give me a break. Give me a break.
Yeah. Well, cats in particular, I love cats, but they don't ponder a sunset and they don't create symphonies, right? Yeah. So there's something unique about humanity where God has given us this cultural mandate to take the materials of creation. In this sense, creation is not finished because God gives us a cultural mandate to make beautiful things, to build culture, right? And so I think you think about the artistic, the artist that helps build the tabernacle in Exodus 31 through 35, like the stones and the artistry there is in a sense it is symbolic. It's pointing towards the reality of who God is. So I think if you're a Christian and you're listening to this and you're an artist, I think again, art is a way to understand culture. It's a way to be challenged in your view of the things around you. It's a new way to see. I remember taking art classes as a kid. I think my parents put me in art classes when I was probably 5 or 6. And I remember my art teacher at one point, she took this well-known painting by one of the Renaissance masters and turned it upside down and told us to recreate it. And it was infuriating because, you know, you turn a painting upside down, you can't make sense of it, but you're learning to see the brush strokes, the shapes. You're learning how the different pieces of it kind of fit together. But it taught me, it taught me a new way to see the world, right? Noticing the details and noticing the expertise of the craft of this Renaissance master and the way he's using paints and colors and different things like that. I think as Christians, we need to grow in our ability to do that. And so in the last chapter, I guess it's more of an appendix of the book, I talk about art being imitating our creating God, our communicating God, but also as we enjoy art, we exhibit our imago Dei, our uniqueness as being created in the image of God, and kind of give some ways to do that. And you know, one is just anytime you approach a piece of art, you listen to a piece of music, you watch a movie, you are consenting to that piece in a sense. You're saying, I'm going to be attentive to it. I'm going to let the message of that piece speak. And I'm just going to watch and examine. So there's 4 C's because I'm a Baptist pastor. But the first one is a consent. The second one is craftsmanship. You know, you go and look at one of Van Gogh's paintings and you see the brush strokes and you see the use of color. You see what, you know, what makes the small pieces that make itself, like make the totality of the painting. You start to understand those things and really appreciate the expression given there. So there's consent, craftsmanship, content. Again, this is where you watch a film, you listen to music, and it's a window into the culture or the worldview of the artist. I mean, you look at some of the really old paintings, Renaissance before, you get a sense of what the culture is like. In the jewelry, you see what was maybe culturally communicating wealth or power. You start to see the furnishings and things like that. It's a window into a different world, if you will. So you have to understand the content. And then finally, the context. This is where I'd say learn about the artists themselves, like what their personal story, what shapes their worldview, what maybe kind of led them into their practice. Because every artist creates in a specific point in history with their own cultural values, with their own background. You know, so we go back to that painting of Christina that actually turned out to be the artist's neighbor who was his lover, but she was also had some physical issues where she couldn't walk by herself. So when she's laying out in the field, like she's literally paralyzed from the waist down and she can't get back. And so that sense, when you're looking at that painting, like, what is she reaching for? Is there somebody in the background that's coming to help her? Like, all of that's embedded in there. It gives it more meaning as you see the piece.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, you know, ages ago, and I think Russ Ramsey even wrote about this in one of his books. I don't know, but looking at Rembrandt's Return of the Prodigal Son painting in a new way. And we actually for years, you know, for 20 some years had a print of it hanging above our mantle. And you just start, the more you stare at it, it just looks like a dark painting of a guy, you know, hugging the son on his knees. But you see like one of the father's hands his hands look different. One hand looks masculine. One hand looks feminine. The figures in the background, like, is that the older brother? Is that just a servant? Is that, you know, the more you stare at something, the more you begin to see sort of the contours of the thing. And certainly, you know, what you're speaking to here in terms of not just appreciating beauty, but being shaped by it, you know, is reflected in, you know, you referenced 2 Corinthians 3 earlier, right? Like what we stare at shapes us, what we behold, we become. And so if we're looking at the glory of Christ, the beauty of Christ, we can become more like him. The book is called Drawn by Beauty: Awe and Wonder in the Christian Life, Drawn by Beauties by Matthew Z. Capps. It's available now wherever good Christian books are sold, from B&H Academic. So I guess it is an academic book. I lied about that, but it doesn't feel, it's not big.
Well, I'll say I wrote with like an understanding of the academic conversations, but I wrote it for the regular. Yeah.
It doesn't read. I mean, when I first read it months ago to provide an endorsement, it didn't read like an academic book, at least not the way some folks do. So do pick it up, dear listener. Don't be intimidated by the academic talk. It's a super helpful book. Can help you sort out the appreciation of beauty and artistry and other things in your life. And if you enjoy the beauty and artistry of this podcast, give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church.
You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.